Hello and welcome to Power Reflections, a proud member of the Diff Network, where we reflect on Wildbo's most dashing work as it releases. I'm Ruben Morehouse.
I'm Elliot Diebold.
And we're here for a reflecting episode, which means we've got a very special guest with us. It's Megafire. Welcome, Megafire.
Hello, hello. Nice to be here.
Yes. It's nice to have you here. Beluga was correct. We have Megafire with us, who you may know from their incredible, you know, essay. Is it right to call them essays? It feels very lofty because they're Reddit posts, but then again, they're so packed with incredible details that anything else doesn't sound right.
Yeah, I occasionally struggle with what to call them. I go with posts or essays or whatever.
But all kinds of things about dynamics, parent-child dynamics, power dynamics, all kinds of things in Wildbo stories.
I guess because you sort of got a bit of a start, unless I missed the even earlier days, doing Carol in Ward. Yeah. And then I don't suppose you could have possibly imagined the buffet Wildbo would then go on to provide you in Pale when it comes to parenting.
Yeah, it was pretty nice to see to meet Verona's dad, so to speak. That's the only time I'll say that meeting Verona's
so
dad
to speak,
was nice.
You don't even think he counts as Verona's dad.
Yeah, but listen, this is the only context in which I'll describe meeting him as nice. So
it was the nice, not the dad part that was the so to speak.
Exactly.
Nice for the material it was going to provide.
My
sister has just finished arc one of the story. She's sort of trying to catch up now. And she's been messaging me like thoughts after every chapter. And I think I got one after like 1.8, which is just like, I don't really like Verona's dad. And it's just like, oh, you have no idea where that's going to go.
Yeah, that, I think by 1.8, we were all still in that boat. We were like, yeah, this guy seems weird.
Totally. I mean, he's so insidious, right? That's the insidious thing about him. Elliot, I hope you responded to your sister by saying, oh, just wait, he'll become one of your favorite characters just to fuck with her and see how her thoughts would evolve.
So the problem is this is actually going to be her first Wildbo work. So she's not pre-programmed with that idea that 90% of the characters she hates initially will find either redemption or at least like an understandable perspective.
Yeah.
She's at that point. I think you're right, Mega. Like at the end of arc one, you see this and you're like, I don't like this guy, but he, you know, if we can fix him up, I think it'll all be okay.
Yeah. You feel like at the end of that arc, you're like, man, Verona and her dad just need to sit down and have a good chat.
Yeah.
Which is so not what needs to happen.
Yeah.
Oh, we just put him in some anger management and it'll be fine.
Yeah. God.
I mean, speaking of, villains getting backstory and explanations through interludes, should we dive into this arc?
Sure.
So let's first give a summary of the arc for those who might not remember all the way back to 11.1. It begins with Verona's mum dropping her off at Jazz's place and even being convinced to join the sleepover. Lucy and Verona sneak off to do some magic stuff and meet up with Avery at their cool new hidey house base. And they come up with a cool plan. Avery joins the sleepover and the girls uncomfortably sleep before they move forward.
I think I say this every one of these reflecting episodes, but holy shit, that was this arc.
You're not wrong.
Yeah.
So then we head into 11.2, which is basically Avery's anxious countdown to the trial with Edith, but it's disturbed a bit when her family joins everyone for the fancy bagel breakfast.
Yay.
After a quick sort of shopping trip with Verona and Lucy, she and Lucy head to Tasha's place and they sort of heal a bit physically and emotionally. But Avery's sort of weirdly bad about accepting Lucy's apology. Then the Kennedys meet with some of their allies and reinforce their protections. Avery's parents drop a bombshell on her and then the Kennedys put on some makeup and head out with the Sable to fight Edith.
And then in Just In Case, we get our first and I think only extra material of this arc. In it, we get a peek at the letters the Kennedys wrote to the loved ones in case things go wrong. Avery tells her family to run for the hills and thanks Mrs. Harley. Verona prepares Jeremy to replace her and maybe resurrect her if he wants to. And writes her parents the letters they deserve, which is to say, none. Lucy thanks her mom, but also prepares her to go nuclear if things go wrong.
Just sorry, Ruben, before you start 11.3, just another bit of commentary. Geez, they really sat down and wrote these letters before the wrong one of these confrontations.
Before the wrong trial, yeah. Seeing how this arc ends. Yeah.
Oh, God, yeah.
I mean, maybe they can just reuse them, you know?
Well, I didn't get the impression they did, but hopefully that just happened off screen.
Be nice.
So, yeah, at 11.3, we jump into Avery's head and we begin the trial of Edith James. The Kentys give Edith multiple chances to, you know, not be guilty, but she clearly is, so it doesn't work. They take a quick break to interrogate the Sable about what the fuck he even does, and then things get sealed when the girls show Matt the syringe.
Then we move into 11.4, which is now alone. Edith is, because, you know, Matt's gone upstairs, Edith is continuing to get pressed by Lucy, who's basically trying to figure out whether they're willing to compel answers out of her through binding. Edith can't give them anything on her co-conspirators, but admits her own guilt. And after a talking to from John, she's bound by the Kenneteers and the Sable. The rest of the town learns of this and they vote for their new leadership as the girls head out to clean up the mess they just made that we didn't realize how bad it was going to be.
Yeah, speaking of that mess, in 11.5, Verona goes out to fight some echoes and spirits, then goes on a very expensive shopping spree and starts to run out of supplies. The Kenneteers fight off a horde of immaterials, try to make friends, and sync up with Matt before heading downtown to help there.
11.6 continues the spirit battle. The Kentis fight against a wraith king, queen, prince, something. After some intense flashbacks to some cringy gift giving, Lucy and Avery don't end up needing Verona's help to vanquish the wraith. The Kentis sync up and then start building shrines. Verona goes off to chill with Jeremy for a little break.
Yeah, and while she's doing that, apparently for her break, Lucy decided to spend the day with Guillaume, because the concept of rest means nothing to her. So Guillaume teaches her how to fish rather than giving her any fishes. He also tries to fix up her hair. But as things are getting a bit dicey, the day is saved by our gallant hero, Gashwad. Lucy then faces the scariest monster she's had to fight yet, which is asking out the boy she likes. And she tells Avery and Verona all about it as they head to meet up with Rook to discuss next steps.
Then in 11.8, Avery zooms Liberty and her posse. After some negotiations revolving around whether Declan is gross or just sad, he's in, it's both, Liberty agrees to help. We then see the rest of the...
I'm sorry.
Elliot, you fool.
We then see the rest of the plotting with Rook about how to tackle Marissica, and then Avery pairs up with Lucy to build more shrines, freaking out about their own mans, about her own mans, as she does so.
11.9 continues with Verona is welcomed to the KT, bitch. Before she adjourns to Moonlight as a mad scientist, discovering the rare element of anti-smoke. She then makes some nice new bracelets for the team and attempts to teach Declan biology as well as how to be a human being.
Yes, and in content with being sufferable in 11.9, 11.10 opens with Declan just going all out on being a piece of shit.
Mm-hmm.
When he's called out for just being wrong. Luckily, Connor is here to maintain balance and the status quo, make sure the boat does not get rocked, which, as Pale has taught us, is a good thing. And then when Avery walks out of her family's bullshit, we go to meet with the much more pleasant Goblin Mayor.
And then in 11.11, Verona leads the team as they capture the car bomb spirit for Toadswallow, said Goblin Mayor. They take their spoils to the bartending mayor, who offers the weary travelers some advice alongside the permissions they're asking for. The gang gets everything they want, but are beginning to realize how little that matters.
Yeah, 11.12, we get into... Well, we're starting to get closer to Marissica's judgment. Lucy first needs a quick therapy session to clear out all the mental cobwebs. Equipped with the power to win arguments, she and Verona knuckle down to reinvent themselves for the upcoming fight before visiting... a reluctantly reconciliatory Declan and learning of each of the Kentiers' new roles and masks.
Yeah, and so then 11.13, we see each of the Kentiers, it's one of those .all chapters, They all do their final preparations, and then we see the start of all the bullshit that we're going to get into in Arc 12, presumably. So they chase Liz and Sig around. Lucy's picking out some of her favorite curses she wants to try. Verona cooks up a nice smoothie for herself. Avery tries out some glamour again. And it seems like things are going well. They're just about to catch Liz. And Marisica, well, sort of, shows up.
And then in 11.z, to round out the arc, we jump into Marisica's head. We see her from her birth as a toddler. Nice, clever. And then the trial she's had to undergo to survive her home court and get a chance to escape. We learn her motivations. She doesn't want to be a fairy or Marisica at all. In fact, the Canneteers aren't talking to her, but an imposter. As the Canneteers corner themselves, a lady departs.
A glum ending to the arc, but a pretty good arc overall.
And the longest, I believe, both in chapter count and word count.
It sure feels like the longest, yeah.
Yeah, it's crazy to me that 11.1 was Verona returning to Kennet. That is so long ago.
Yeah, we had just found out that Miss was back.
Jesus.
Feels like Miss has been back for ages.
Yeah, this is when we learned about, you know, the House on Half Street.
Yeah, that's only been in this arc. That's a good point. That was in 11.1. Which I maintain my opinion that everything about the House on Half Street is great, except the fact that it didn't appear in this story till Arc 11.
That's fair.
Yeah, it's one of those things where it's like, you know, Snowdrop, a core character to this story, who just wasn't there at the start of it.
Yeah. Imagine if Snowdrop had been introduced in Arc 11. It's like, you'd still love her, but you'd be mourning the 11 arcs she wasn't in.
Yeah.
Or 10.
So should we get into our general thoughts on this arc? What do we all think of it?
Well, we're reaching the end game, aren't we?
Yeah, definitely feels like it.
Yeah, right?
There's still a few big twists to come, I'm sure.
Yeah, I'm probably still counting on things like the promenade to come back to some degree as well. And I'm trying to figure out how that fits into, you know, a potential arc 12 or 13 or whatever, since I'm assuming we're going to kind of dive straight into like being at war with Marisica. Like, so,
well, there are some people who strongly hold on to the theory that the wolf is actually the mastermind behind all of this. So if that turns out to be true, I'm sure that's how the promenade will come back in.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that the promenade got got more focused this arc when they asked Declan for help with it. It has to come back after that, right?
Yeah. I just don't know when we fit that in.
Yeah, exactly.
it would be wild for like the town to be on fire. They get away from this other fairy, and it's just like,
let's go to the promenade.
Yeah, I just need a break from this like 5 minutes, you guys. I'm just going to dip into the promenade
and wait for the wolf to show up. And have some.
I mean, maybe that's
guy.
The backup they need. Maybe they're like, maybe Avery's going to be like, I know something that might beat Marisica.
Yeah, I know something that Marisica would never expect.
But that would be the ballsiest play.
Well, I mean, she's got the mask, right? Like, she's already one step towards doing that.
God,
what if Avery ends up hosting the wolf? Can you imagine?
God damn. Yeah,
this is not an official prediction or theory. I'm not endorsing this at all.
I mean, you've said it, so if it comes true, you can get the credit now.
Yeah, but do I want it? Do I want to get it for this?
Yeah, the credit slash blame.
Yeah, there we go.
No, that's definitely you sort of jokingly do a lot of hypotheticals on a show like this and then remember that this is just going to go out and sort of be permanently there. And yeah. Maybe you didn't mean everything you said. But then, if it does happen, you're a genius.
I mean, it's an Otherverse podcast. You should be careful about what you say anyway.
You think I'd be better at that after like going on 2-3 years doing these podcasts? But I'm still terrible at it. I've learned nothing.
Yeah, well, sometimes it just takes a little more time.
Yeah, you'll get there, Elliot. Yeah, it definitely feels like we're ramping up to the end of the story. I mean, all these things are kind of converging, coming together. There's so many things that feel like they're all just happening at once. Guillaume's fall, the trial, end of summer deadline stuff. We still haven't got that that meeting between Ray and Charles, which I'm holding out hope we're still going to see at some point.
Yeah, but it's going to be weird with the thing we just learned in Mariska's interlude, isn't it?
Mm. Charles's guilt.
Yeah.
I know Snowdrop's Tiny Fan had their very well-researched post today on Reddit about how he's probably the original mastermind.
Mm.
But I'm still sitting in my corner with my fingers crossed that my boy is an unwilling participant.
What's our read on this? Because, like, I mean, Marisica said currently Charles is an unwilling participant, right?
He certainly feels like he's under her.
Not necessarily true, but it seems pretty clear that Charles isn't, not everything Charles is doing he wants to do, let's say. I'm interested to hear your take on this, Mega. What do you think?
Well, he did have the clearest motivation out of all of them. Like, he tried to get an audience with the Carmine Beast to have his forswearing looked into and basically was denied. So he has the clearest motivation of installing someone else who can then look into his case again.
Mm.
But, you know, I never saw him as enough of a bastard to go through with the whole hunky choir thing just to get
So this is kind of something that that Snowdrop's Tiny Fan post hinged on, I think, was the idea that Charles's actions were at least initially very much, you know, in anger / desperation, and he's probably cooled quite a lot since then. Even with that, though, like, we saw Charles, even when he was still a practitioner, he was pretty sick of you know, the whole being a practitioner means you're a shithead kind of thing.
Yeah.
He did have a bit of a history of doing...
of overreacting.
Yeah, this sort of shit. Maybe Marisica caught him trying to pull the plug, and that's how she got involved. I don't know. I'm grasping at straws because I've just always kind of liked Charles, and I don't want him to have been, willing for at least most of this. If he acted out rashly and then got trapped in it, I can live with that.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. It would mean he has even more weight to carry than just the whole karma thing.
Mm. He's got that guilt. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's getting harder and harder to deny that he's somewhat heavily involved.
He's definitely heavily involved regardless.
Yeah.
So what else are we thinking about this arc? Mega, what were your thoughts on this arc?
Well, I had a couple of things because I have been thinking about justice as a main theme of Pale, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And you then enter an arc with 1.5 trials and, you know, you get some interesting stuff to talk about. And the first thing I had was the civil rights issue, because we've known for a while that the justice system in the other verse is pretty archaic. And since we now have a better idea of what the judges actually do, we can look into that a little more, because I remember way back in, what was that, arc 7? I don't remember. Alexander described himself as harsher than the universe demanded.
Mm.
But in this arc, the Sable Prince made it pretty clear that the Canneteers were way more merciful than the universe would demand. So clearly there is some room for interpretation in karmic law. Like, you can push it towards some more harsher interpretations and towards more merciful interpretations. But in that case, it looks like most people just go for the harsher ones for some reason.
I've gotten the impression that the spirits don't like it when you make shit confusing. So I'd imagine that sort of might play into it, where if Alexander just steps up, and I think you're right. I think it was 7.x where he forswore Seth, and he kind of just gets up and Alexander just says, he's bad, he did wrong, hurt him. That's kind of a lot simpler to process than the Kenneteers being like, well, look, she made a mistake and she's done a lot wrong, but, like, you know, we don't want to just forswear her. We want all these complicated results that, like, require maintenance and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, to take the analogy of the spirits as a kind of audience or you know, representation of, you know, the zeitgeist, as it were. Obviously, we as humans love a nice, easy, quick, snappy soundbite that can sum up a decision, right? We hate to have to hear all of the context and all of the nuance that goes into some of this stuff.
Yeah, we have too much to think about already.
Mm.
Yeah, simpler ideas travel a lot easier.
Yeah, and as a result, you get, like, differences in how forswearing empowers practitioners usually, but the way they bound Edith actually weakened the Kenetes.
Which is just, as you said, so aggravating. Like,
yeah, you get a really strong incentive to just be an absolute asshole.
To be shit, yeah.
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 I mean, doing the right thing is, it's difficult, and it's, they're explicitly going against the grain of what these systems kind of demand, right? That's making concessions and you know, compromises constantly.
Yeah, yeah. There's very little incentive to be merciful and offer others the right, you know, the rights our justice system gives people here. The only counter incentive I can think of is community pressure, because like if the Kenneteers did go ham on Edith, they would have immediately lost the mandate they have from the rest of Kennet.
Mm-hmm.
They would have been like, yeah, we don't want these kinds of practitioners here, and they would have immediately turned the entire town against them, and that would have been bad.
Yeah. I guess that's that difference between like this sort of raw practitioner power and then the softer and ultimately greater power that the Kenneteers have sort of started to develop, which is just everyone's always on their side because they're good people and they do the right thing. And like, you know, hopefully Pale's making the case that that's the long-term play.
Yeah, because the fact that they, you know, they're in a community with others,
yeah,
that makes this incentive a lot more present and means that doing the right thing actually has some benefit. Of course, this isn't helped at all by the fact that Edith herself refuses a lot of the attempts at being merciful and just goes, no, fuck you, bring the hammer down on me because I want to put you in that position where you have to. And
yeah, that was dirty.
Yeah. It's the same thing, who was it, Bridge, I think, did a couple of arcs ago.
Yeah, although he just forced them to compel him to give an answer. He didn't, doesn't Edith start to also do it with like, I'll answer your questions on my co-conspirators, but you've got to know that will kill me. So your call, like really putting them in an extra awkward spot, because it's not just compelling, which is bad. It's like, I'll do this, but it will kill me.
So do you want to live with that? Huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. And as a result, like it feels really dirty that they use Matthew to pressure her, but you know, when she's completely stonewalling them otherwise.
I don't know if use Matthew to pressure her is even the right wording. All they did was reveal a pretty horrific deceit.
Yeah, well, and again, they did it at the end. Like the reason I feel like we can sit it kind of easy on that is like, I feel like the Kenneteers gave her so many chances before they revealed the syringe. It was sort of like, please work with us.
Let us, you know, be kind to you. And her response was just, fuck you.
Yeah, but the thing that bothers me, right, is that the deceit of Matthew doesn't really have anything to do with the case they're actually after her for.
That's fair.
And like, obviously, in this case, we go along with the narrative, with the story, and we're like, yeah, it gets results. But at the same time, if you're looking at this in a pure law enforcement angle, which I think is an interesting lens to look at this whole arc through, given how it ends, you kind of go like, yeah, that's kind of dirty, isn't it? It's kind of a bit of a bad cop versus good cop kind of thing. So in the end, I don't think I disagree with the decision they made, because yeah, I mean, she was completely stonewalling them and being an absolute bitch. And also, it's if they can make this whole thing fall apart just by showing Matthew the syringe, I mean, you kind of did most of that yourself, Edith. But
yeah,
like to what degree here do the ends justify the means, you know?
I guess my question for you would be, do you think there were any means the Kenneteers undertook that need justification?
I think only actually showing the syringe and bringing that up in what is a different kind of case, because they have been offering Edith an advocate and she said no, but the advocate she had in the room was Matthew. And then they used the syringe to get that advocate out of the room and leave her weakened and alone. And that, you know, there are some issues with that.
Yeah.
I don't think it's completely right that the syringe is disconnected. I mean, it was clearly designed by Marcy. And if we take knowledge that the Kenneteers wouldn't have had, it was her, you know, her reason for jumping into the conspiracy. But you're right that you can definitely see how it's not great that they use it and how it's used.
I think it's sort of lessened by the fact that they did genuinely offer her another advocate. She just said no. And at that point you're like, yeah, okay, but we have this revelation for the one you do currently have in your corner, and I mean, sucks to be you, I guess.
Yeah, although, what can you do?
In her defense, she didn't sort of just not want it. The Sable added all that other bullshit where it was going to have to be like 2 days or something.
To find someone who could actually represent her.
Yeah, which like, yeah.
Well, she could have picked another Canada or something, you know.
Yeah, just pick Nausicaa. Problem solved.
Exactly. That would be a win-win-win.
I think she might have gotten unraveled if she pulled Mariska down. But Mariska would have taken care of that pretty quick, I guess. Yeah, I don't know. People who aren't getting enough hate in this conversation are the Sable, the judge.
Mm.
I'm still not over that part where he like traumatized Edith in the black room for a bit.
Well, we don't know
what the hell happened.
Yeah. It's like, it's bizarre to me that like, that got maybe one comment when it started of like, I think it was Lucy being like, what the hell is this? And then it came out. It's like, oh, Edith looks like she's really traumatized by that. Let's keep asking her questions. It was like, are we not going to ask about that?
Yeah, we see this later on also with the Aurum, I guess.
Mm.
The judges are really powerful. And when they actually do their things, you have to start asking a lot of questions about how they operate and what they're doing and why. And I don't think we have the full picture of those things yet, in part because they do a lot of this behind the scenes, and when nobody can see what they're doing, you're just like, yeah, I would demand a little bit more transparency from this whole system.
Yeah.
Just to be able to tell whether I'm agreeing with how this operates, yes or no.
Yeah, well, and then you know, obviously this underlying principle of karma, like we've already talked about that a bit, but that definitely needs another look at, like the idea that simple but brutal is rewarded more than fair but complicated, like that sort of suggests a bit of a go back to the drawing board situation.
Well, that's kind of what Kennedy is supposed to be, isn't it?
I think so. It's still like, we've never gotten the speech from Miss about what she was actually exactly trying to achieve.
Yeah.
I feel like somebody needs to sit down Miss and be like, could you give some sort of villain monologue-esque description of what you're trying to achieve, please?
You're allowed to add some maniacal laughter in there if it makes you feel better.
Yeah, how come the goodies never get an explanatory monologue about their goals, yeah, huh? That's what we need from Miss.
I mean, I think she kind of got one when they met her on the light bridge.
Mm.
And she did, oh yes, this is how we became what we are, and we're not okay with that.
Mm.
Yeah, but like that sort of covered her motivations, and I have this general idea of, you know, she wants to weaken the seal, is the impression I get, and like kind of even the playing field a bit, and I can get behind that. I'm just wondering if she has concrete thoughts on what that looks like.
Yeah, yeah,
like, if you went to things with this idea of like just wanting to tear down the system and without a plan of what building the new one looks like, well, that's how you end up just doing things like killing the Carmine Beast, right? Like that's, you know, like anarchy has its own problems. I feel like Miss is smart enough to have a pitch of what she's aiming for. I'm so curious to find out what that is.
Yeah, that's kind of what we thought Rook was doing. Like, we thought she was just the burn the whole thing down type. But I think we can safely say that was severely underestimating her. But for Miss, I always felt her as more incremental. Like, she's trying to establish Canada as a proof of concept. But, you know, what concept exactly? What exactly does she want Canada to be, I guess?
Yeah, because we keep hearing that from Rook that Miss is thinking very long term.
Mm-hmm.
Which I find interesting because, like, she calls Toadswallow, she calls him out for being sort of somebody who's just rushing things, but he seemed to be thinking decades in advance. So either Rook's misunderstanding him or Miss is thinking like hundreds of years in advance.
Yeah.
And I agree. She seems like the sort of person who wants to incrementally wear away at things. I'm just interested like what her pathways for that look like.
Yeah. Cause the whole thing about her thinking so long-term kind of matches with that thing fake Mariska says, how Miss and Rook would see everyone dead.
Oh yeah,
because they're just thinking that long term. Because
they're planning on being around in 500 years when their plan is half done. Sort of deal, which means all those people are dead.
That's an interesting explanation of that line. From...
Except for Verona, the Echo Cat. She'll be the last one.
She'll still be hanging around, absolutely.
Interesting. So what other thoughts do we have on the Ark? So we talked a lot about the justice system, the trials present within the Ark. Anything else that really jumped out to any of us?
Yeah, I also had a bit about politics, because, I mean, Pale is very much a political work. And one thing that stood out to me this arc was that little conversation Bluntmunch had with, I think, Verona about what it meant to have taken out this pillar of the community in Edith. And yeah. I'm kind of thinking, like, on the one hand, it is very good for the health of a community to show that even the leaders can be taken out when they did something wrong, that the people in charge are not immune to consequences. But, you know, a community can only handle so much of the leaders being taken out on these accusations before it falls apart. And Bluntmunch mentions this, uses the metaphor of a table where you take out one leg, table's fine, but if you take out a second, you're probably in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
So the question here is, like, how do you support a table, and how much of that is your responsibility? If you're a local law enforcement, basically, like, those priorities kind of conflict. And to what extent do you value accountability versus supporting the community and keeping it upright?
Yeah, like if you have someone like Edith who's in charge and is, you know, far from perfect, obviously, but like they have to go through this, all this fighting of wraiths or, you know, something equivalent every time, and it's going to keep getting worse as the power is removed from the town. Like, at what point is good enough?
Yeah.
Right? Like, because otherwise you're just leaning into that anarchy of, you know, destabilizing things so much you just take away everything.
And part of this could, of course, be self-serving, because we haven't eliminated Bluntmunch as a suspect. So he could just be saying, yeah, hey, maybe slow down on this whole going after people thing. I don't want you coming after me very soon, you know?
That's what was so great about it, is because Bluntmunch is suspicious, it's a conversation where you kind of like, you want to listen to him and what he has to say, which are good points, but you also kind of want to be like, yeah, but I don't trust you, so I'm gonna keep your thoughts, you know, at arm's length.
I gave him the benefit of the doubt just because it was so suspicious the way he said it that I was like, no, this has got to be fine.
I mean, it's an interesting, you know, political philosophy to think about, which I hadn't expected to come from Bluntmunch, to be honest.
Yeah, you don't expect goblins to be the source of philosophical thoughts.
I mean, you know, we thought Toad Swallow was kind of unique in how thoughtful he was about his own society and the culture he lives in, but, you know, Bluntmunch occasionally has his little insights.
Yeah, especially because, like, the fact he's thinking of this, like, I guess both myself and the Kenneteers had absolutely no idea how much it was going to knock the town down to bind Edith like this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The fact that they dealt with, you know, 4-5 chapters, I think it was 4, wasn't it, of needing to run around putting out wraith fires was it really drove how much this is a key decision to take away one of the legs of the table, as it were.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, part of that is obviously the fact that Edith herself deliberately sabotaged things so it would be this bad.
Yeah.
Well, but I think the wider point still stands.
Yeah, exactly. And like, because arguably this is their second thing along these lines, because doing it with the Hungry Choir also heavily weakened the town. And there's probably a case for the Aware having been less of a problem if the Hungry Choir was still around.
Mm-hmm.
So there's definitely like a case that this already was the second leg they took off the table. And, you know... using Toad Swallow and the shrines and a lot of hard effort, they've sort of put together like a pile of books to keep the table up. But if they go after anyone else, they're going to be in trouble.
Yeah.
With Marcy potentially going to be off the table and Guillaume's fall to winter, I wonder if that's going to indicate that the town is going to be especially vulnerable to, I guess, fey shenanigans, or especially receptive to goblin shenanigans or something.
Yeah.
I mean, it's starting to feel more and more like Toad Swallow's Market is kind of the best case scenario for Canada.
Because it's weird. A lot of the original others we met will be gone at that point in some way or another.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know what Miss's plan was exactly, but it's feeling more and more out of reach if she just wanted this to be a normal town that was starting to erode the seal, because it just, it's so much of what the town was is going to be like irrevocably gone.
Yeah. I think some of the replacements make up for that a little bit, but yeah.
That's true.
But, you know,
Nibble and Chloe make it.
Yeah, and Tashlit.
Yes.
But speaking of the whole goblin culture and Toad Swallow, we definitely got a lot more perspective on Toad Swallow's plans this time, because we saw his interlude last arc, but in this arc we had him like actually talk about it. Mm. And I don't know, what are your opinions of the society he wants to create?
Mixed.
Yeah, I know, right? What answer can you give to that? Like, I think it's, if this was the only thing that you know, was potentially going to happen to Kennet, then I'd be like, no way, Kennet doesn't need that. But given the whole other weight of potential disasters hanging over Kennet, you're kind of like, well, it's not so bad.
I think his answer of an eighth court for goblins is kind of great in a way. Like, it definitely feels like an improvement over what we saw in his interlude in the Warrens. Like,
yeah,
it does feel like a step up for goblins, but it just, like, I don't know, will it be better? I guess that's something the Kenneteers bring up with him, and this is like, you know, putting people like Snowdrop in positions of power is certainly a good first step, but like, I worry all he's going to do is like soften some edges of goblin culture, but also introduce rampant capitalism to them, which, like, that'll go great.
Yeah, but in that vein, like, the current situation for goblins in, you know, wider society, human and practitioner society, is that they basically just get exterminated like vermin.
Yeah.
And this goblin market that he wants to set up definitely gives goblins more legitimacy within the wider sociocultural milieu, just to use some pretentious language. Toad Swallow would appreciate it. And, like, even historically, capitalism did help a lot of people out of poverty. It stagnated since and resulted in what we currently have. But at the time, it did.
Oh yeah.
Do a lot of good. Yeah.
Capitalism became the standard for a reason. It was because it lifted a lot of people out of poverty to begin with. It's when you enter that late stage
we see in how Toad Swallow talks about things and the criticism the Kenneteers have of his ideals of his goblin market, that he's still leaving a couple of goblins behind, because instead of just their capacity for violence, he's judging them by their capacity for uniqueness, and there are still going to be some goblins that just fall outside of that. But at the same time, it does save a whole lot of them, and it, you know, means they don't just get exterminated anymore, which is definitely a positive. So can you tell him no if you don't come up with a better solution immediately? Because can you justify telling him to, yeah, no, don't do this, wait for another opportunity and let, like, all of those other goblins die in their violent births and get exterminated by practitioners whenever they pop up?
Yeah, it's not a perfect solution, is it? But it's at least a step in it's a pretty good direction.
I guess I'm just interested to know, like, I just can't help but picture that, you know, 100 years down the line, it's like the fairy courts aren't great. Like, and that feels like what he's trying to emulate in a way. Like, you know, if that's his sort of end game, to be on par with them. I don't know. Like, we're back at, it's a step up, but it's not like perfect.
Yeah. Mm. But, you know, don't make perfect the enemy of good, as the saying goes.
Yeah, exactly. Right. True. You gotta start somewhere. You gotta start shifting the needle.
I think Toad Swallow underestimates how much backlash there would be to this. Like, you know, as soon as it starts to get compared to the fairy courts, I think a lot of goblins and a lot of fairy are not going to be super impressed.
Yeah,
and you mentioned he's going to be leaving a lot of the more like violent, shitty goblins behind. My concern is, you know, will they get worse and become more of a problem for everyone else to deal with? That's not really a criticism of his plan. That's just more like a concern that will need to be addressed in some part of it.
Yeah, because that's the question about goblins, right? They're basically violent little shitheads, and they get exterminated all the time because they're violent little shitheads. But we see in Toad Swallow's interlude that some of the goblins that are born aren't like that, They just get immediately culled by the internal selective process.
Yeah.
And
it's the same with the fairy too.
Yeah.
In 11.z.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm like, there's a lot more there that if you just encourage different starts, like encourage different behavior right from the get-go and not have things descend into immediate violence like they do in the Warrens, you can get goblins like, I don't know, Cherry Pop and Peckersnot, who are just a lot of fun and really cool to hang out with, and they just get to exist in Kennet where they might not otherwise.
I fully agree, and like that's the thing I like the most about Tozol's plan. I'm just thinking though, if you leave a huge chunk of goblins behind in the Warrens, they get to kind of double down on the more toxic parts.
Yeah,
with that, and you know, then you end up 2016 election in the US.
But I'm like, will it? Because the Warrens don't seem like they have a lot of pressure to not double down anyway. Like it seems, I'm not sure if allowing for the nicer ones to flourish elsewhere will necessarily take away from the way the nice ones flourish in the Warrens, because they just don't.
I mean, that's true, but then also we did see like Toadsaw's little nerd club.
Yeah,
they were doing all right.
Yeah,
yeah. I don't know. Yeah, I see your point. I guess part of it might be if there is another place to go, more of the better goblin. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. It's difficult, and like, a lot of goblin culture is really messed up, in part because of the violent start most of them have, and in part because of how they're treated by the outside world.
Yeah.
And, like, I have a hard time seeing an attempt to build something better as wrong, even if it might have some backlash somewhere else. Like, I think the thing Toad Swallow is overestimating is how valuable everyone around him will immediately see this goblin market as being, because I think you need to first establish yourself and prove that having you around as a potential resource is better than just wiping you off the map from the get-go. And given the way, you know, people deal with goblins, I think that startup is going to be a little bit more difficult than he imagined. Or maybe I'm underestimating him too, because he does seem to have put a lot of thought into how to get started. So
no, yeah. I think you're right. I mean, like, even just the fact that, you know, if a practitioner hears about this goblin market, the first thought is probably, well, that's bullshit. Well, that's whatever, you know, like, even just to get over the prejudice, there's going to be a lot of, you know, a lot of work needing to be done.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think like the early access users will be like goblin practitioners probably.
Mm.
So you start with very targeted marketing towards like Liberty, America, and all the other goblin affiliated practitioners. And honestly, that might be, I think he's mentioned at times that the Kenneteers are going to be important for how he sees it going, and that could be a huge part of like having three practitioners as
evangelists,
brand ambassadors.
Yeah.
Is probably, you know, super important and valuable.
And I mean, having Snowdrop as the goblin sage also sort of lessens the whole, the regular messy goblins kind of thing.
Yeah,
it kind of established that. Yeah, there's a little more going on here.
Yeah, it's distinctly goblin, but it's not like the old, like, you know, all goblin sort of thing.
The question then is, to what extent will, for example, what were they called, les gendres? How much will they care for that nuance?
Yeah, there'll be some educating to do.
Yeah, they'll just go, goblins, they're taking over the town. Let's burn it down.
Fuck them up, yeah.
Yeah. Like that's the big problem, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's fair. There's gonna be a lot of naysayers to deal with, let's just say.
Yeah.
So yeah, a lot of interesting future plans for Kennet, I suppose. A lot of things all coming to a head.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then there was speaking of things coming to a head, there's that end of summer deadline that continues being a deadline for more and more things at the same time.
Yeah, just suspiciously so.
Yeah,
like, yeah, obviously the universe likes a good story and likes when things come to a head at the same time, but this is getting a little bit much. And at this point, I'm just like, are we going to wait with all of them until the deadline? Like, are we just going to sit back and watch all of this come to a head, or are we going to try knock things off before that deadline? Because otherwise, it gets a bit much at the same time.
Hmm.
it also just feels weird. Like, Pale, to me, just doesn't feel like the story where, yeah, the deadline happens, all this shit wraps up in a nice little bow, and then we'll have an epilogue 6 months later where everyone's happy. Like, maybe I'm wrong about that, but, like, setting itself up as a murder mystery where the reveal of who did the murder isn't the end game, it then feels weird to then just go, and here's this one day where half of the book is going to finish at once. And
I mean, I think there's definitely going to be other stuff that we're going to want to see more of that just isn't going to resolve itself fully in this story, right? I mean, we know Wabo's keen on doing some more Wildverse, Otherverse stories at some point.
Yeah, but saving it for the sequel, I guess, is fine with me because that means there's a sequel.
But yeah, I mean, however this might end, it has massive ramifications for, like, what Kennet is and what Kennet looks like.
Yeah, yeah.
So, like, after this, things are going to be markedly different, but all the things we've seen established for after this deadline, they just feel like they don't matter, because in this very arc, Avery's mom tries to bribe her with maybe getting a car when she's 16, and, like, narratively speaking, nobody gives a shit. Like, that it feels like it just doesn't matter, in part because it doesn't matter to Avery, but also as an audience, you're just like, yeah, we're not going to see that, so we don't care. And, like, the other verse is something where narrative tropes and the actual magic system work together a lot. Like, they're basically the same thing. So the fact that these are things that we as an audience don't care for says something about what it's going to mean within the story itself, I think. So all of this is just, like, it's going to be some massive paradigm shift. And that's really rough to put on the shoulders of 3 13-year-old girls. And, like, all of the, I don't exactly know where to go with this, but it feels like it's too much, you know? The three of them are absolute troopers, but this is maybe asking too much of them.
Yeah, well, I mean, we all remember the fallout after Arc 7. It would have been 6.x when Seth got Forsworn. Sorry, that was a while ago now. But yeah, like, most of Arc 8 was like, or at least the first half of it, was the Kenneteers just, like, emotionally recovering.
Yeah, I think it's interesting also to take note of the fact that a large number of the original Kennet others intentionally picked practitioners young enough that they thought they wouldn't be able to handle it. So almost explicitly by design, this is too much to put on the shoulders of these three, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So that's going to be interesting. I wonder what the climax of the story will end up being like for them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And how they'll prepare themselves for it, I guess.
Yeah. It's scary stuff.
And then, of course, we get to the final bit of this arc, and that's the Mariska trial sort of thing.
Because not going well so far.
Like, the Kenneteers themselves ask a lot of questions about, you know, the way they approached Edith was very by the book, very, you know, traditional justice system kind of way. But Mariska, they don't approach that way for what are pretty good reasons, but also the alternative is a goblin raid. And you're just like, yeah, but that doesn't seem to match with our idea of justice very much.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering what your perspective on that was.
to pull back the curtain a little bit, we had a fairly lengthy discussion about that in the episode on 12.1 and 12.a we recorded about 2 hours ago.
That makes sense.
But, yeah, like, it's definitely, it's this weird thing where if you come at a fairy fairly and civilly, they'll use that against you.
Yeah.
So, like,
that's a weakness. You're
balancing these concerns of being unfair and rude against, like, wanting to be fair but knowing that they'll abuse that. I don't know what the strategy is meant to be.
Yeah, I think the only thing I can say for certain on that is in both approaching the Mariska and the Edith trial, God, the Kenneteers have done exceptionally well given the circumstances.
Yeah, they really went the extra mile to make sure things went well.
Yeah,
which, like, is to their credit. It's just with something like Mariska, I don't know if there's a right answer, because the more slack you give her, the more rope you know she can hang you with. So yeah.
I've compared like trying to put Fairy on trial to just having someone who can afford a really good lawyer.
Yeah.
And like within our usual justice system, we like that. We try to give everyone the right to an attorney, but you know, not everyone has the same means to get the same level of attorney. And you get stuff like this where one of them is just really good and, you know, massaging the rules, so to speak, and putting someone else up who hasn't actually done anything, but who is definitely cooperating with you, but, you know, all of that noise. And, like, how do you deal with someone who can just play the system?
Yeah, because completely circumventing it and doing something, you know, like the Goblin trial could almost be compared to, like, mob justice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In a way. And, like, that doesn't feel... I don't know if it feels better, but like, that doesn't feel like a clean answer, but it feels like the available one.
Yeah, because are there clear answers? Are there clean answers? Because I don't think so.
No.
Because,
yeah, I agree.
Like, clearly the system as it stands can very easily be manipulated.
Yeah.
And, like, to some extent, we accept this as a fact that, yeah, you know, sometimes you manipulate the system a little bit. But in this case, it means that some people just cannot be held to account because they're just so good at jumping through loopholes and God knows what else.
Mm.
It does come back to a bit what Lucy said to, I think it was Toadsaw when he was making his pitch for the Goblin Court, and he mentioned doing some violent or bad things to help form it. And Lucy sort of said, you've got to be really careful when you're doing that because you're going to help create a culture where that is still seen as a method that's okay.
Yeah.
Mm.
And, like, that's the concern with things like this Marisica stuff is like... Pale's talked a lot about the idea of like what the precedents are and setting precedents. And if we sort of establish the way you deal with Fairy is to build unfair mob justice sort of stuff against them, that doesn't sit right with me. But I also don't have something better.
Yeah, because the alternative is just, yeah, try to do it fair and just let him get away with anything.
Exactly.
And you're like, yeah, that's also not good. And I think, as we see by the way this attempt to catch Marisica went, that neither of those are the right option. That Pale is making it pretty clear that no, neither of these things really work. But I'm very curious to see what it has in mind as an alternative.
Yeah.
I don't know if we're going to get ever a fully satisfying alternative, because I think it's true that I don't think there's any system that is perfect and incorruptible, right? Like, I think that's just the case. So any system that you want to have any kind of longevity for these kinds of things needs to accept... Hey, sometimes the people in control of the system are going to abuse it.
That has been an interesting theme in Pale, is this idea of there is no set of rules or one system that like, or there's no set of strict rules or system that will be fair to everyone, but also giving people arbitrary powers will just, you know, lead their own biases to, like, either way, you're getting somebody's biases, whether it's the people who write a rigid system or it's, you know, the people who are given, like, arbitrationary powers. Like, somebody's going to abuse shit somewhere.
Yeah, it's what I call the idiots and assholes principle. Like, it doesn't matter what system you set up, you're always going to have idiots and you're always going to have assholes. Whatever system you have, the asshole, some kind of asshole will be taking advantage of some kind of idiot.
Yeah, I like that.
And like, I think our responsibility as a society is to try and make it so... to limit the amount of assholes that can take advantage of other people. Yeah. But like I don't think we're ever going to be able to completely eliminate it.
No.
But on the other hand,
naive to.
Yeah, exactly. But on the other hand, when you get to something like Marisica, who is responsible for the death of a whole lot of people, that doesn't feel like a satisfactory answer.
Yeah.
I feel like, I again, to bring it back to something you said as well. It's the whole idea of not letting perfect be the enemy of good. Like, it's that idea of, like, even if we can't fix all of them, you want a system to be adaptable to the point where you can, like, handle shit when it happens. Like, a big problem we're finding with the Seal of Solomon in Pale is it's grown way beyond what it was originally. It was written in a very different time, and the like, with that context gone... but with a bunch of rigid rules in place, like it just hasn't adapted well. Like what you need is a system that allows itself to change to suit the times a bit better.
Yeah.
Like there don't seem to be any like amendments to the Seal of Solomon at the moment.
Yeah, there haven't been like official amendments, but the meaning has still like shifted to become more than was initially the idea behind it. And nobody's really looked into whether that's how they wanted things to go, or at least not on an institutional level.
Yeah, exactly. So that would for me be the end game that you'd want to aim for. Is like, yeah, perfect's probably unattainable, but you want to be aiming to just always try to get better. Like, yeah, as you say, when the assholes do manage to find the loophole in the system, have the system be built so that you can get the assholes to fuck off and, you know, patch it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a difficult question that we obviously also run into in real life.
Yeah.
And if there were easy answers for it, we wouldn't be in the mess we currently are.
Exactly.
Yeah. What else happens in this arc that we liked? We noted earlier how the house on Half Street only exists within this arc so far.
Yeah, and it's such a fun location too.
Yeah, it's nice to have a base that's not tainted by any... I mean, tainted is the wrong word for Lucy's house, I suppose, but, you know, not tainted by parents.
Yeah, it's just a clubhouse, man, and I can't believe we've gone like 10 arcs in this story without the kids having a clubhouse. I mean, come on.
House on Half Street, it's just such a perfect magic story clubhouse name. Like, everything about it is perfect.
Yeah, I really love it. And I love the fact that Verona set up her little mad scientist alchemical and whatever else nonsense thing she decided to set up in there. And that,
especially because it's such like, she's got such upcomer vibes. Like just, you know, she's using like slightly cursed copper pipes that came from like another... it's so unofficial, everything about her setup. I love it.
Yeah, and the fact that she just decides to smash a shelf because she's like, yeah, this isn't where I want it to be, and smash. I can just do that. I can just take that down and then put it up the way I want it to. Holy shit. And I love that. I love the fact that especially for Verona, she has this level of freedom suddenly that she's never had before. Something she can turn into her own space.
Yeah, because she had it a bit in the Blue Heron Institute with the way the brownies would do the furniture, but that was limited. Mm. It was a temporary accommodation. It was a space she was like, that was quite small that she was sharing with two others. This is very much like a semi-permanent place that she's planning to set up in.
A domain, maybe.
Yeah, we'll see. Hopefully.
Because like she's... You know, she's flinched at the idea of having a domain of her own, but the moment you give her own space, she starts doing this kind of stuff with it. And I'm just like, yeah, that's what I imagine a domain to be like at any at any rate, you know? Like what she did just now, but magic, or even more magic.
The thing that scares me about a domain and just buying a house in the real world, and would especially apply to a 13-year-old Verona, is... The problem with the domain is you're not moving. Like the house on Half Street, I love it. It's great. But also, I don't know if I'd want Verona locking herself in there for life.
See, I have an answer to that. And it just came to me. And I think it's a bit cheeky. But remember how they get to the house on Half Street? By a bit of city magic.
Yeah.
So maybe she might not have to move. She can just turn the key and walk out somewhere else.
Yeah, I suppose depending on how her relationship is with Ken and wherever she moves to, maybe she can get that key to work anywhere.
Yeah, exactly. Or at least within a radius.
Yeah, I think, and you know, there's been talk of like domains. I think Avery talked about it, like domains that just have like doors opened onto paths and stuff.
Yeah.
So I don't suppose there's any reason you can't like move into an apartment in Toronto and just, you know, add a door to one of the walls that goes to the house on Half Street if you've got the power to do that.
Yeah. Oh, I'm just thinking, you know, you turn the key and then the street outside this, you know, the road that leads to the house on Half Street, then instead of going into Kennett, just goes into Toronto and you're done.
Yeah.
You don't have to actually change the access to the domain itself. Just change the access, you know, to the house. It's a little different. I'm not explaining this well, but.
Yeah. No, that feels like it would just be harder to me though, because then, I don't know, like, just because of the way that stuff works in my head, like the way the house on Half Street's hidden is sort of by Ken, and I don't know if it's teleporting as much as like,
true.
I don't know. But like, yeah, no, I guess you've got a good point, because if you've got access to it from anywhere like that, and I mean, in a way, Verona is already tied to Kennet for life through the pledges they all took when they awoke. So yeah, actually maybe having a domain there where she can whip out a door to Kennet from anywhere where she settles in the rest of her life is actually really good, because then it's like, you know, if she sets up shop down in Australia, but then needs to go to Kennet for whatever reason, she's got like a quick pathway from her, you know, apartment in Australia over to Canada.
Yeah, as a purely hypothetical example, of course.
Oh, yeah.
A practical example. Yeah, I'd love to have a way to go back and forth between Canada at will.
Yeah. So I'm saying that I'm thinking that she shouldn't just she shouldn't discount the possibility of the main suiting her just yet, given the way she just handled things the moment she got some time on her own in her own place.
I also want this idea to be explored, just because I want Rook's input on it.
Yeah,
hmm.
Because I mean, the fact that Rook was set up as someone who challenges the main claims, I mean, there's no way we're not going to get a domain claim in this story. It's just not going to happen, right?
Yeah.
But also, yeah, because like, and then we also got, you know, this Verona who came back at the end of Arc 10 now with this environmental spin on her. And in fact, as I'm saying this, I feel like maybe we talked about this a bit in our Arc 10 reflecting episode. But it just feels so perfect to have, yeah, Rook as the person who is the domain challenger and has said she doesn't support domains. And then Verona is a domain candidate who's environmentally conscious. Because I think Rook said to, was it Reggie, like, when they take a domain, it's gone forever. So there's this sense of, if there is an environmentally friendly way to do it, like, Rook and Verona would be the two to find it with their current, like, philosophies. And I just love to see that explored. But again, yeah, that makes sense. Do we fit this in?
Oh, God, yeah. Fuck.
That's got to happen in the epilogue arc, you know.
Well, I guess, like, you know, there's always the chance that they deal with Marisica and then there's another slow point before the main climax. I just can't picture what that looks like at this stage.
Yeah.
Maybe Marisica will, like, get away and she'll just run away for a bit.
She'll come back be like, 3 years later.
Well, no, it'll be like, oh, well, Marisica will be back on the deadline. That gives us a week. Hey, why don't we go get some domains and go to the promenade again?
Oh, yeah. That could be it. What are we going to do to power up so that we don't lose to her again?
Yeah.
Could see it. So should we ask the classic question that we have to ask every single reflecting guest?
Well, do you have anything else you wanted to bring up, Mega, before we hound you with these tough questions?
No, I think I've gotten through my points, so go right ahead.
Well, the question is, who's the best Kenneteer?
Well, that's for me, that's been Verona from the get-go, and that opinion has very rarely wavered.
Yeah.
What is it about Verona that you especially like?
I like the fact that she thinks a little differently than most. There's been a lot of talk about whether she might be autistic or otherwise neurodivergent, and that makes it so that I kind of relate to her a lot. Because for those of you who don't know, I'm also autistic, so that connection was very strong from the get go. I think I was immediately like, yeah, this is the one. This is the one I stand. And like the fact that she's a little weird, she does her own thing. She has some non-traditional approaches to relationships. That sort of thing is just immediately very interesting to me. There's also the fact, of course, that she gives me a lot to write about.
she has
a terrible parent. That's about her.
Oh, she's got two. Like, well, Sylvia's no brain.
In different ways, but yeah.
She's no Jazz. Like,
yeah.
Yeah,
the fact that Sylvia had to be convinced to stay over for the night. God damn it. What is wrong with you, woman?
No, I do agree. Like, the Verona's unapologetic nonconformism has just really appealed to me from day one. Like, I think the moment we were first introduced to her in 1.1, where there's a creepy faceless woman watching her do dishes, and she's like, yeah, fucking come kill me, I don't even care. I was on board.
Yeah. Her introduction was very strong.
As the always consistent Verona stan, I do have to admit, Avery has been creeping up and up this whole story, and it might be close to drawing level. I just continue to be floored by, like, Avery's journey.
Yeah, I'll admit, when at the start of the story, I didn't connect to her much, but she has been going on me since then. But the only one who ever unseated Verona for me was Lucy during the implement ritual.
Yeah.
That was just fucking awesome. And yeah.
Worth noting, there was a poll on the subreddit recently, you know, informal, but still. And Verona stands had about twice as many votes as...
Lucy and that was weird to me, because I've been following those polls for a while now, and for most of the time...
Verona's always been at the bottom, right?
Yeah.
Wait, really?
But the spread was a lot more even, you know? There wasn't one clear winner out of those polls. But now suddenly Verona's on top, and I'm like, wow.
What changed?
When did that happen? Because, like, in ARC 10, Verona just wasn't present.
The stuff with Verona when she was on away with her mum, I think, maybe has helped clinch her for a lot of people.
Yeah, and that is interesting, though, because, like, if that poll is super recent, like, you know, ARC 10 is now, like a month and a half to 2 months ago.
Yeah.
4 or 5 days ago, so pretty recent.
Yeah, so that, like, that's got to be more reflective of the vibing in ARC 11, which is interesting to me, because, like Mega, I've been a Verona stan since day one.
But maybe
I wouldn't have thought she has any standout moments in the.
I think she had two this arc. The first was her mad scientist setup, which is just a ton of fun.
Yeah.
And the second is that we saw her take charge when fighting that car bomb spirit. She was the one who took the lead on that and put everything together.
People like people who spend a lot of money on water bottles as well.
Yeah, maybe it is just her enviro spin. I don't know. Yeah. I know, I agree, Mega, those have been highlighted, but I guess, like, relative to the rest of the story and relative to Lucy and Avery, I wouldn't have thought there was any, like, I would have pointed at the end of ARC 9 as my guess to when Verona, like, would have shot up in popularity or something. It's interesting that it happened halfway through ARC 11.
Yeah, that is true.
And so I assume you're still, as always, Team Lucy?
Heck yeah, I'm Team Lucy, which is the best. And actually, I started out Team Avery, but I've switched over to Lucy and I will never look back.
Okay. Poor Avery. So that, no support for her today.
I do love Avery, but it's like you said, I find Verona very relatable in that way that she, so I suppose our other new question that I think we only started last arc, actually, but I'm trying to make a staple, is which Kennet other would be your first choice for Familiar?
Yeah, my first choice for Familiar would be Liz.
Ooh, interesting.
And I know this is probably kind of weird considering that she's now definitely a villain. But I think we could both give something useful to each other, because I think she's looking for some kind of stability, and she got roped in by Edith and Marisica mostly because they offered her that and she was kind of desperate. And I'm not sure what sort of stuff they've been whispering in her ear. But, you know, I don't think it's all been very accurate. But I think being a familiar would give her a little bit more stability, a little bit more something steady to hold on to, you know? Having an actual identity that she's connected to would help her find her own level, would help her give her some time to put her legs on the rug and figure herself out.
Yeah,
and
that, on the other, makes
and,
sense.
Yeah, and on the other hand, her ability to blend in and all of that stuff would really help my social skills. I'd have a lot easier time integrating into new environments with new people, just having an easier time getting along with people and making new friends, and that would also be nice.
So that's why tap into her ability to, like, read the room and become part of the
group, you know.
I really like that.
What were your choices again for that one?
I feel like my choice for this changes every single week.
Well, who is it this week then?
You know, fresh. I think it's John. I can't remember if that was my same choice last time, but John has always just been my favorite of the Kennet others. So I'm not looking at it from any kind of tactical skills-based perspective, just like, who would I the most want to hang out with?
Yeah, I think that was your answer last time, but I'm not sure. And I wouldn't know where to go looking in the... 5 fucking hours of audio we recorded earlier.
Oh god, yeah, those were two long episodes, weren't they? Jesus.
I think my answer last time was Toad Swallow, and I think that's still my answer.
Mm-hmm.
As much as I'm critiquing is playing in this one. I think, you know, as much as I love Cherry Pop and Pekkasnot, I can't see a way that that relationship would be balanced in a way I could, like, reconcile. Yeah. Toad Swallow, I don't think Toad Swallow would want me, but I think we'd be good together.
Yeah, I think that's also an interesting question to ask. It's not so much what could an other give you, but what could you give to that other in that kind of relationship?
Yeah, I remember, for those who don't follow Jay's live reads on the Doof Discord, I think Jay at some point was doing discussion questions and had one along that line.
Yeah, I think so. But that's been a while ago.
Yeah. Oh, I just remember it because I came up kind of empty. That's why I didn't answer it. I was like, I don't know what I'd offer.
Yeah, when you asked this question last time to Jenny and Malia, I immediately went, oh, I would pick Liz. And I was like, wait, why would I pick Liz? And I started thinking about it. And, you know, it actually works really well for me.
Yeah, I thought you had good answers both, like, for both what both of you would get out of it, which is really cool.
Cool. Other traditional stuff that we do in each of these is diving into the arc title, Dash to Pieces. Now, I'm familiar with the expression of something being dashed to pieces, you know, like broken into pieces, basically.
Yep.
Anything else that jumped out to either of you?
That's essentially the interpretation. Yep. The only interpretation I could think of. I guess there was a lot of running around, like, just to take a quite literal interpretation of dash.
And a lot of picking up the pieces, but, you know.
Yeah. Like, but I mean, like, the first thing that jumps into my head when I think of this arc and the term dash to pieces would be what happened after Edith.
Matthew's relationship, yeah.
Oh, well, not just that, but, like, what happened to the town after it, like.
Oh,
yeah. Like, the stability of the town was kind of dashed to pieces. Like, they, you know, they spent half the arc running around cleaning up that mess.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess the other definition is just, you know, dashing to already broken pieces to pick them up, which is what the Kenneteers did once the whole town broke.
Oh yeah, yeah, that's a good interpretation. I think also just to zoom in on Avery, like her family broke up. Just in general, most of her hopes and dreams as well. Like she had a pretty rough arc in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Her concept of home is falling apart in front of her.
Yeah, when they split up, I was when that was announced, I was tentatively hopeful for a minute that having the smaller home would actually be better for her. But, you know, two chapters after that, we saw what that home was like, and I had to rescind my opinion pretty much immediately because, goddamn it,
yeah,
we haven't talked about.
For me, it was as soon as we found out who was going where, and it was basically all the people who are, like, at all sufferable moving away, and I was like, oh boy.
Yeah, we haven't talked about it as much in this episode, but I wrote that whole post about it a little while ago.
Yeah, I think you covered it very well and comprehensively in that post, so we'll chuck that in the comments of this episode if you haven't seen it, but Megafire did a great write-up on Avery's sort of whole home life and situation. It's really good. Yeah.
Definitely worth checking it out in case you haven't read it.
It's how I've been learning about transactional analysis.
Yeah.
Anything else?
This is a bit of a different thing, but I was more surprised the Kenneteers themselves weren't more broken up. I guess when I saw Dash to Pieces, one of my first thoughts starting Arc 11 was I was predicting in my head that the Kenneteers would, like, you know, maybe you finally have a fight that caused them to stay apart for a long time, especially when we had that, like, bit with Lucy and Avery right at the start of the arc where Avery didn't really accept Lucy's apology. So I expected them to get more split up and be more at odds, and, you know, they just continue to be unbreakable.
Yeah, I was thinking more of Verona's mask, which was, you know, broken apart, and I was worrying that was going to happen to the other two as well, but nope. they just switched out their masks on their own.
They can't be stopped, this trio.
They dashed themselves to pieces and built new ones.
Yeah.
And look how it's working out.
Any other stuff we want to check in on from this arc?
It's not for this arc. I just quickly wanted to pull out a connection I made after our recording last week as we finished up our stuff of Arc 11. In the 5.2 extra material on the different fairy courts, Marisica says, Darkfall is my court and I would not trade it for another. And I just, knowing what we learned about her at 11.z, I just, Wombo's a fucking mad genius. Like, this is just, what? Yeah.
Yeah, that's what really clever wordplay. Fuck. It was right there.
Yeah, like, his ability to still trick us with wordplay, like, you know, 6 years and 2 million words into a series that's built around tricking you on wordplay, it's just incredible.
It's really good. Yeah.
But yeah, you think we would have figured it out by now.
You can't ever. He's always one step ahead of you.
Yeah, no, trying to keep up with Wombo is like trying to keep up with a fairy, as far as I'm concerned. I'm not capable of it.
Yeah, you just, at some point, you just got to go with the flow, you know?
Or do we need to treat him like a goblin and just start throwing out really shit predictions?
To throw really him off shit his game. And blunt predictions.
Well, in that case, I had it covered at the start of this episode, so.
Well, I guess that's all of our thoughts for. Well,
technically, our other regular segment is theories on who done it.
Oh yeah, true.
You definitely have a leg up on some of the people we brought in like 10 arcs ago, but
yes, my current list of suspects are Edith, Marisica, and Charles. Mm. I know it's very groundbreaking.
We'll see.
Interesting. Care to expand on why you think they're involved? Though I suppose, I don't know. Do you think there's a secret fourth conspirator?
Well, maybe Bluntmunch could be a secret fourth conspirator, but I'm not sure. I think they might have just taken the goblin stuff from him because the goblins don't seem to hold on to their stuff that well.
I know it's not as popular as the whodunit, but something that I think might be worth asking in this case is the why done it. Do you have a strong thought on the motives of our conspirators? We probably know Edith's, we know Charles. Do you think we have enough info to peg Marisica?
I think Marisica's motivation is set up something big enough where she can throw another fairy under the bus as herself and use the chaos to escape.
Mm. Well, she also,
I think that might have been it.
Yeah, from my memory of 11.z, it's like her backup plan is the Carmine bullshit is chaotic enough that it technically meets the criteria for her to graduate.
Yeah.
But her primary plan is to basically escape her identity as Marisica by sacrificing someone else and then not even be trying to leave becoming fairy was like part of it. Like she had this, you know, Oni-ish vibe, you know, the Kennet classic at this point, which is I don't want to be the category the universe put me in anymore.
Rejecting labels, yes.
Yeah.
Do we think there's any other? So with that then, we have pretty solid, you know, means, motive, and opportunity, to borrow the phrase. Do we think there are any unknowns there that we're about to be revealed by? And if so, I mean, I think we probably all think that there might be. At least I definitely do.
What I get stuck on is the damage. Mm. Because the Hungry Choir killed a whole lot of people.
Mm.
And none of the motivations we've seen so far seem like they'd be enough to drive someone to that extent.
Mm. Definitely not Charles. I can see Edith and Marcy not giving a shit about that.
Yeah, but like, maybe not give a shit, but also, like, being responsible for that many deaths, if it comes back to bite you, you know, you hang.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure Edith is that dumb to just try that, you know, to just... I'm not saying she would be morally opposed. I'm thinking it would be too much risk, you know?
Mm.
And I still feel like there's a little something we're missing here that it doesn't justify what they did, but it justifies it in their minds.
Mm.
This scale of things.
I don't know. Maybe it's just desperation. I mean,
yeah.
For Edith and Marisica, at least they both give that kind of desperate vibe.
Yeah, that would make this whole thing a tragedy of this whole thing getting out of hand.
Yeah,
yeah. I mean, what's funny though is like because. I was constantly grasping for the straw of like, I don't see how this plan fits together and it must be Marisica's motivation that we need to put it all together. Now we got that in 11.z and it was like, okay, now I understand her side, but it also established she came in later. So you're right. Yeah. It's kind of like, okay.
There's something missing here.
What were Edith and Charles up and to? Maybe others like thinking? What were they on about? Yeah.
Yeah, I'm still not sure. I still feel like there's something with... We don't quite have a good grasp on yet.
Yeah, because it just, I can't believe my boy Charles would do that. Like, everyone always reminds us he can lie or whatever, but he seemed chill.
He seemed chill, he did. Yeah.
Like, we saw him in that, you know, 7.x, the Alexander Go Bye Bye interlude, and we saw him in Edith's interlude. He seemed too nice to be someone who'd commit to something like that long term.
Yeah.
Please, Charles, please live up to that.
Yeah. But I do have a very bold and specific prediction that I've had for a while now, and that's that Miss will don the first.
Oh, interesting.
Ooh, I like it.
Because I've always seen, from the moment Bristow's system was questioned and they asked Nicolette if he'd be willing to step down and not be at the head of the system he's creating, and he said no, he was not willing. And yeah, she said that no, he was not willing to make that kind of sacrifice. Mm. I was thinking, okay, Miss is also trying to build something new like that. And what would it take for her? Like, if we contrast Miss to Bristow here, she would make that sacrifice. But what would that sacrifice mean for her? And I'm thinking that's allowing herself to be defined. And in the context of this story, that would be taking the Force out of the hands of the bad guys to ascend to that judge role, even though, you know, that would be a very unpleasant thing for her to have to go through. But it would be the personal sacrifice to see her vision of the future realized.
There'd definitely be a tragic aspect to her donning the furs.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which definitely, in a Wild Bo story, earns it points as a prediction.
I like that.
That's fascinating. Because I'm just trying to think, sorry, did we ever find out what the fuck John meant by the fact that the other judges were going to make his... No. Carmine journey more palatable?
No, we haven't. We still haven't seen the full explanation for John and the Sable's interactions.
Okay.
Yeah, and now that we've seen the Sable, it seems even weirder.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Who knows? Who knows? Well, I guess that's everything to talk about, isn't it? We will have a back to packed section, but we'll do our outro first for our non-packed reading listeners.
Final thanks for coming on, Megafire. This is great, and we've been enjoying your posts since early Ward, I think. So
yeah,
it was great to talk this out with you.
Yeah, great to have you.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome.
I'll post the link to Megafire's latest post on Avery in our Reddit discussion thread, and you can use that to stalk post history and find all the others too.
Yeah. And and you can also find me on the Doof Media Discord, where I do my live read of new Pale chapters twice a week.
That Discord is free to access, by the way, for anybody. So go to doofmedia.com/Discord to access it.
Yes, we're usually doing those live reads at the same time these days as well, which is very funny. I'm almost, as I'm sitting down to live read all the time, Megafire just starts theirs, and I'm just like, oh, damn it, and I can't read it.
Yeah, and I always have to wait until I'm done before I can start reading your Twitter posts.
speaking of, if you want to catch those Twitter posts, you can go to Twitter at PaleReflectCast, which is where our Twitter feed is, where Elliot does his live reads.
Yep, and it's also where we post about delays in the episodes, like this one. It's a bit later than usual, and you would have known that if you're following us on Twitter.
Yeah, so you only have yourself to blame.
Don't forget to stop by doofmedia.com. That's where the details on all the Doof shows are, including the other Otherverse show, Pale in Comparison, who we've teamed up with.
Yeah.
Our group name is Pale Comflections. We're doing a fan art contest again. So get your art in for that. Check the website for more details.
Yeah. Make sure you support us on Patreon and support Wild Bo on Patreon at patreon.com/Wild Bo.
Okay, should we go back?
Back to packed. Heck yeah.
Indeed.
Okay, so now that Malia and friends have left us, what do we want to say about packed?
Yeah, I was actually inspired by Malia for this little back to packed bit, because she mentioned in Pale in Comparison how different Pale Goblins seem to be to Packed Goblins.
Mm.
And since this arc focused so much on goblins, that got me thinking. And I pulled out a quote from one of the earlier chapters in Packed, All of the most foolish and brutish others have been captured, slain, consumed, driven off, or tricked away. Recognize all others for what they are, and know that they, by a process of elimination 2,600 years in the making, are cunning by nature. They are slaves to those who are, or they were made to be cunning to better serve their duties. Wit is the greatest defense and the sharpest weapon on battlefields such as these. And I've been thinking about that quite a lot. And now knowing what we know about goblins and goblin culture and how they come to be and the way other societies develop, I think we can safely say this is self-serving nonsense. because, in part, because it completely ignores the degree to which these other societies develop and new people arise in it with new perspectives. And it's not like, you know, all the kind ones got eliminated and there are no new kind others arising anymore, so get fucked. Instead, it just primes practitioners to take an immediately hostile approach, which, you know, then becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah, you're right. Like, there's that one part that where it's like they're either cunning by nature or whatever, or they're slave to those who are. And I think that's the point that lends it like a little bit more legitimacy if you want to defend this perspective, because, you know, we've seen the goblins and the fairy get born into these shitty cultures that kind of, you know, either Darwinianly like get rid of or shape them into sort of what this paragraph is talking about more often than not. But you're right, it's such a self-fulfilling prophecy, because if you treat them all as if they're hostile,
yeah,
your relationship with them is going to be, wait for it, hostile.
Shocking.
Yeah.
Because when you look at others, like, for example, Nibble and Chloe, they aren't within any of those categories. They aren't cunning by nature or slave to those who are, or made cunning to better serve in their duties. They're just people.
Yeah, it's particularly ignoring others who form of humans, like humans who turn into others, like Nibble and Chloe, like Matthew.
Alpi.
Yeah. Got it. See, Alpi's not, I mean, she's negligent. She's not hostile.
I think, I don't know, looking at early Pact now, especially reflecting on it through Pale in comparison, it's very apparent that entry-level practitioner material is just anti-other propaganda.
Right? Like, yes.
Legitimately.
Well, like that was why I was so blown away when we got the stuff on familiars in Arc 6 of Pale, because, you know, it probably took me half of Pact to really start to clue into a lot of the societal stuff I was talking about. That just really wasn't the way I thought before we started these podcasts. And like when I read the opening to Famulus in Arc 2 of Pact, I was just like, ooh, cool magic stuff. And then you start reading it in Arc 6 of Pale and you're just like, holy shit, this is just talking about, like, enslaving them.
Yeah.
But the first two paragraphs were completely unchanged. Like, it felt to me like Wildbow just sort of flexing on the fact that, no, he's been on top of this for 6 years now. He was already there in Arc 2. Like, you know, it's just when you're reading Arc 2 of Pact, unless you're a lot smarter than me, you just didn't see it back then.
Yeah, I think part of that has to do with Blake's desperation. Like, you don't have the time to think about this kind of stuff.
I think Blake also just objectively meets a lot more others who would meet this classification than like Pale is definitely sort of taking that step back and saying, hey, that shit Blake was dealing with is actually the minority. Like, you know, the others that are out there. Because
of Granny Thorburn and demons that...
Well, yeah, and he had shit karma. Like, the universe was throwing the worst it could at him.
Yeah.
But, like, you know, shit like the hyena, for every hyena, there's, you know, 1,000 cherry pops is sort of the point Pale's really going out of its way to make.
Mm-hmm. Well, the worst thing is to think that the hyena probably started out as a cherry pop, and who the fuck knows what that looked like.
Hyena Jesus. Pop.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm thinking of doing, like, a pact reread when Pale is over with the specific lens of, what the fuck is wrong with Jacob's bell? Because... like the goblins in Jacob's Bell are pretty much assholes, and we see that that's not necessarily true.
I don't think anything's wrong with Jacob's Bell. I think Jacob's Bell represents a pretty good picture of the norm.
Well, I don't know about a good picture of the norm, but like to your point, Mega, like that to me just feels like it's coming from the top. Like the way, like a town of that size with so many practitioners in it just creates an environment where the goblins were under more pressure but also had more free reign.
Yeah.
And I guess all you need is someone like Butsack to be one of the most powerful, and it creates an environment where that's the like main vibe of goblins. Whereas in Kennet, you have like Toad Swallow slash Blunt Munch on top, and both of them by goblin standards are pretty chill.
Yeah.
And that lets someone like Cherry Pop or Peckersnot get their feet in.
Yeah, that makes sense.
We didn't see too many of the smaller goblins in Pact, did we? Like, we never got the time with the Cherry Pops.
Yeah, what use were they to anyone in the story?
There was that one, what was the name of the goblin that Blake lets into the Duchamp, or no, the Behame House?
Oh, I know what you're talking about, but I don't know what his name is.
It had a funny name that had dicks in it. I suppose that's most goblins, but it was my first goblin, okay, so it stood out to me.
Yeah.
Oh, no, there was also Rose's mate, the one who watched her do Eamon.
Oh, God, yeah. Shit, what was that guy's name?
I've still headcanoned that that guy became her familiar, the black cat.
But, you know, would a goblin turn into a, like, smooth black cat? Yeah, I would think it would be more mangy than anything else. Yeah.
I'm not saying my theory is based on any evidence aside from the fact he's one of the only others we sort of see her with. That's basically it. I just like the idea. And maybe she was refined enough for the two of them that he came out as a kind of refined cat. I don't know.
Or when she was describing the proposition, she didn't use the word cat. She used something else.
Maybe he was glamoured to... Actually, no, you wouldn't do that to a goblin.
Yeah, that would... I mean, Grandma Rose might.
Yeah, that's fair. Wait, I don't know. Maybe she hit up one of Fell's mates for some illusion magic or something less offensive to a goblin. Anyway, sorry, this was such a mind.
What were we talking about?
Anti-other propaganda is what we were talking about.
Yeah. I mean, it's so interesting. Like, I'm actually about three episodes behind on Pale in comparison now. I really need to catch back up. But, like, I just can't wait for Malia to get more and more exposure to demons, just because the kind of irrecoverably evil others, I think, are going to catch Pale readers so off guard in a really interesting way.
I'm so excited to see Pooh's as the entry point to that. I think that, because he's borderline, right? He kind of feels half goblin, half demon, and I'm excited for that to be the entry point. And then the fucking hyena, can you imagine what Malia's gonna think? Oh, fun goblin to take down. And then the hyena, who's fucking horrifying.
Yeah, because she's already been like, the last thing I've listened to was her like reading the Maggie interlude, and she was like, oh, these couldn't be goblins, like, maybe they are, but that's not goblins as I know them. And it's like, oh, wait till we get to the hyena.
Oh, yeah.
You're going to see exactly what people are worried about when they think of goblins. Like, there are bad sides to goblins.
Yeah. And then you get, I think once you get to Poe's, it probably immediately makes sense what Clem had in Pale.
Yeah.
That little moat that she had there.
The little foreskin guy.
Yeah.
Talk about chopping off foreskins and eating them. Yeah.
Yeah, that guy. Because, like, as a Pale only reader, you have no idea what the fuck is up with that guy. But, you know, once you've got packed, you're like, oh, right. That's probably a demon. Yeah.
Especially because she takes it to those practitioners on Bristow's, just like, oh, see if you can sell it to these guys. And they just, like, run screaming.
They're like, what the fuck? They still took it, though, but yeah.
Also, just the powers scene from Malia, just because, like, she's a
lawyer, yeah.
But, like, yeah, but she doesn't seem to like really gross stuff. So I feel like that chapter's just going to throw us for such a loop, because she's going to love the contract negotiation as much as she hates
that's so mean.
The grossness. Like, I'm so excited to see her reaction to that chapter.
I mean... Jesus, the contract negotiation is so good in that chapter, because, like, you're like, yeah, we've got this on lockdown. We've figured out loopholes, and then the contract is signed, everything happens, and they're like, ah, shit.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if she figures that out before Blake does, you know?
Yeah. I mean, she'll have more time than he does, that's for sure, with the pace they're going. But will that be enough?
Yeah.
I mean, if she gives it the time, I reckon she probably will. I tell you what, like, based on her response when Pace was coming out to the contract Ruben wrote for us in Pace, I was very jealous that we didn't have her around when Pace was being recorded.
Yeah, she really went for that, didn't she?
She did a lot better than Kipos, Linus, and I can tell you that.
All right, folks, anything else you want to touch on before we wrap up?
No, that was it for me.
Well, then that's the end of the episode. So I guess